This time on your weekly Constitutional.
Boris Johnson is the new Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and he was selected on the promise that he will remove the United Kingdom, withdraw the United Kingdom from membership of the European Union by the 31st of October of this year, and he's called that do or die. And that's his commitment, and we'll see if it really comes to pass.
That was William Walton, a British barrister and a frequent guest on the show, talking about British constitutional issues, most notably Brexit. What's up with that now? Are they actually going to take action? Is Brexit actually going to occur? William knows all about it, and he's going to share his wisdom with us. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's breathlessly awaiting Brexit.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Have you been following the news from across the pond lately? What is going on over in Great Britain? Well, nothing, it seems, except for something called Brexit.
My name is William Walton. I've been on your program before, and I'm a lecturer in city planning at the University of Hertfordshire in Hertfordshire, Southeast England. And I'm also a civil servant with the UK government.
And you're also a barrister.
I'm a barrister, yes.
Which I can understand.
Lincoln's Inn, I was called at.
And you have a long-standing interest in constitutional law, both British and American, and that has been the starting point for our discussions many times, as you say, in the past.
Yeah, and politics more generally. You know, It's not just law and politics, as you know, are really sort of twin bedfellows. So, I have a deep interest in these issues.
As I sometimes tell my constitutional law students, constitutional law is merely politics written down.
I think that's a good description.
Thank you. Tell me about the University of Hertfordshire.
Well, it's in Hertfordshire, which is just north of London, so it's in what we would call the home counties. The main campus is at a town called Hatfield, which is it was an old staging post on the Great North Road between London and Newcastle and Edinburgh. It then became a new town in the 1960s, I think, and the university, part of the university, the new campus, is built on the old aircraft assembly factory for the de Havilland company, which you may have heard of. De Havilland built the Mosquito, which was a famous fighter bomber in the Second World War, and also the world's first passenger jet airliner in the post-war period.
Now, before we get to Brexit, give us just the basics of the fact that we've talked about this many times before, but the British Constitution differs from ours in a couple of fundamental ways. First of all, it's not all embodied in a single written document. And secondly, under the British Constitution, there's a concept called parliamentary supremacy. And so Parliament gets to do pretty much what it wants to do, even amend the British Constitution. All fair statements?
It is, and of course, as we'll say later on, it's been really tested at the moment.
Yes.
The Constitution has been stretched to breaking point.
But take us from 2016 forward. Tell us, that's when Brexit happens. And I'll interject here that we've done several episodes on Brexit, several updates on it. So if people want the real detail, they can go to our podcast site. Just Google Your Weekly Constitutional and enter in the search bar Brexit, B-R-E-X-I-T, and you'll come up with all this stuff and including some several episodes that we devoted to just the British Constitution itself.
Well, let's start in 2015,
okay.
So a year before the referendum. David Cameron, as a leader of the Conservative Party, and essentially as the co-prime minister with in the coalition government with the Liberal Democrats, went to the country on a manifesto saying that we would give a commitment that if we're returned as a majority government, we will provide a referendum to once and for all resolve this issue of whether the United Kingdom should or should not be a member of the European Union. Now, the reason this was promised was that this had been a festering sore, particularly in the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party, many of their supporters have never been happy with Britain's membership of the European Union. And I think I mentioned to you in one of the programs that in 2000, I think it was about 2013-14, the Conservatives lost, and your listeners can check this, they lost two by-elections, which you, I think, call special elections, when a member of Congress or a parliamentarian dies or is dismissed for unparliamentary behaviour and loses a seat. So by-elections were held in Clacton-on-Sea in Lincolnshire and in North Kent, I think it's at Rochester. And the Conservatives should have won both of them, and they lost both to the UK Independence Party. And the UK Independence Party at that time, and we'll talk a little bit about what's happened to them, but the UK Independence Party at that time was the main flag bearer of the anti-EU vote. Very purist, very ideological, in the sense that, yes, they did have policies on other issues, but their defining characteristic was that they were opposed entirely to Britain's membership of the European Union.
And this boils down to one word, doesn't it? Sovereignty. I mean, because Britain had so closely associated itself with the countries of the EU and had, of necessity, ceded some powers to the EU, which then resulted in laws that in some cases were not very popular back in Britain. This is really at the core, isn't it, of much of the Brexit opposition?
It is. This is the argument that when the United Kingdom joined the European Union in 1972-73 and passed the European Communities Act, the effect of that was to cede sovereignty from the UK Parliament to Brussels on those areas of lawmaking that were within the constitutional competence of the European Union. Now, those areas of lawmaking include topics such as consumer regulation, fishing, environment, agriculture. They excluded areas such as direct taxation, but they included indirect taxation. So VAT is essentially European tax.
Value-added
tax. Value-added tax, yeah. And if I use any acronyms and you don't understand, please chip in. But
we should have a translator.
I'll do my best to translate my own.
What did Churchill call the United States and Britain? Two great countries divided by a common language?
Well, we'll come on to Churchill later on.
Okay.
But anyway, yes, divided by common language. But the European Union took away, by virtue of being a member of a collective organization, membership implied that you lost the legislative powers in certain areas. And there was also, of course, the creation of the European Court. That's the European Court of Justice, not to be confused with the European Court of Human Rights, which is a different institution and a different body. But the European Court of Justice would adjudicate on disputes between member states where a member state had not complied with a European law. And some people felt the idea that a European court, a group of people in Brussels, could find the UK government guilty of something to be a little bit more than they could stomach. So this issue of sovereignty has been at the root for many of the concern and the opposition to the membership of this organisation.
So in 2015, the storm clouds began to gather. The by-election
went to UKIP. They did. The Conservatives started to hemorrhage support to UKIP. And I think they looked, you know, the sophologists and the advisers looked at the figures and said to David Cameron, if you don't provide a referendum, if you don't give a guarantee of a referendum, then you're going to lose significant votes to UKIP and you may not form the next government, which obviously any leader of a party wants to do. They want to be the prime minister of a majority government. And I think Cameron came to the view that that was a price worth paying, even though he was himself a very strong pro-Remainer. And he must have been aware that it was a gamble, but he felt that it was a gamble worth taking. Let me just say very briefly before I move on, mm-hmm. We'll repeat this and maybe no doubt later on, but we've just lost Theresa May. Mm-hmm. Theresa May was brought down by the European Union. Before that, we lost David Cameron. David Cameron lost his premiership because of a dispute over the European Union. Before that, we had, forget Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, but we had, in the Conservative Party, we had John Major. John Major was brought down by the European Union, and before that we had Margaret Thatcher, and she was brought down. So that's four leaders, four successive MP prime ministers, Conservative prime ministers, whose term in office has effectively been ended over Europe. It's had a terrible toll on the Conservative Party. And you can see in that sense, if you look at it from that perspective, you can understand perhaps why David Cameron thought, do you know what, let's resolve this once and for all.
And he did so with a widely criticized decision to simply have a referendum, which really is extraordinary. It's like simply putting to a vote in this country, in the United States, a constitutional amendment. I mean, just, it's as if the Republican Party or the Democrats got together and said, let's just solve this abortion debate once and for all. Let's just have a national referendum, and the results of that referendum will effectively amend our Constitution. Is that something that gets done in Britain? I mean, is that
the way you ask the question, you clearly you know the answer to that, and the answer obviously is no. We are a parliamentary democracy, and what that means is essentially we're a representative democracy, and we elect parliamentarians to do the thinking for us and to make the hard decisions on our behalf. We're not a direct democracy. We don't have a history of using referenda. I know in the United States, particularly in the West, at local level, you use referenda frequently. But we don't, and it's not part of our constitutional arrangement.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is William Walton, a British barrister and a longtime observer of British politics. We're talking about Brexit. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week our subject is, as it has been frequently in the past, Brexit. And our guest is William Walton. Before the break, William was telling me how unusual referenda like Brexit are in the UK, but there are some precedents.
We had a referendum in 1975 as to whether the UK should remain a member of the European Economic Community. And that was because, and again, I know I've talked to you about this before on your programme, that was when there was a Labour government, and that was because people on the left, like Tony Benn, Barbara Castle, Peter Shaw, Michael Foot, they said, look, we don't want to be a member of this organisation because it is taking away sovereignty and it is contrary to our socialist instincts. And they persuaded the then Prime Minister, who would have been Callaghan, I think Jim Callaghan, that we should have a referendum. And the referendum voted in favour of remaining a member of the EC.
So there is at least one precedent specifically on the being in the European Union or not, or at least one of its predecessor organizations.
That's right. And before, in the run-up to the 2016 referendum, some historians went back to the news footage of the time and the debates that were had between parliamentarians and on television programmes, you know, centering on the debates in 1975, just really out of historical interest to see, to remind themselves as to the issues that were ventilated. But we've had referenda on, for example, whether cities should have mayors, executive mayors, like you, with strong executive powers like they have in parts of the United States. We've had referenda on road pricing in London, a sort of road charging scheme in London and in Edinburgh as well. But apart from that, we don't have referenda. It's something that they have in Switzerland quite frequently. They've had them in Ireland, but we generally don't. It's just not part of our constitutional makeup. And for that reason, of course, it was something out of the blue. And the other thing is, and again, I know you said this before, you asked me before, well, what was there a requirement for a supermajority? Was there a requirement for any sort of threshold in terms of turnout? And the answer to both of those is no. It wasn't dependent upon turnout, and there was no requirement for a supermajority, so you could have had three people turning up for the referendum, two voting one way and one voting the other, and it would have been carried. It would have been constitutionally acceptable or legally enforceable. So it was supposed to be only advisory, but of course it was also known de facto that it wasn't going to be merely advisory. It was going to be binding because the government had said publicly, we will go along, we will implement the decision of the people.
So
there was an act of parliament, I ought to say that. If you look in the parliamentary website in the United Kingdom, you will find a referendum act of, I think, early 2016. So, you know, it would have gone through first reading, second reading, third reading, report stage, it would have then gone to the House of Lords, there would have been amendments, etc. But it's a very, I've looked at it once or twice, it's a very short act.
And that basically just authorized this referendum.
Yeah,
which, as you say, was technically advisory, but in effect mandatory, because, of course, the politicians are not going to want to back away from it. And then that's basically the history of the last 3 years, isn't it? It's British politicians trying to take this very basic decision to leave the EU and actually implement it. And that was the second major criticism of this, is that how is this supposed to happen?
Again, going back to 2016, you'll remember, because of course this made news around the world, including in your country, but when the third item of news is the resignation of the sitting prime minister, you know it's quite a day. You know, the first two items were the referendum result and Britain's decision to leave the European Union. And then as an afterthought, oh, and by the way, David Cameron has resigned. So it was a tumultuous day and a tumultuous week. And of course, that led to the election of Theresa May as leader of the Conservative Party. We've just had a new leadership election in the Conservative Party. This time it did go to a vote amongst the members. But last time, if you remember, the other candidate, the way it works in the Conservative Party is the votes are taken by the parliamentarians. So they select from the field. So a field of 10 put themselves forward, or 15 or however many. And they're whittled down to two. And those final two are then put to the membership, which now is about 160,000 people.
And these are dues-paying members of the party.
They're paid-up members of the party. A little bit different to your country, where, of course, where you just register as a supporter, and that gives you an entitlement to vote in primaries. That's broadly correct, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But this is very, very interesting to me, because this is a feature of British politics I was not familiar with. So you have basically two votes. If we're going to have a new prime minister, and let's assume one party's in the majority, let's assume that it's the Conservatives.
Yeah.
So the Conservative members of Parliament say, okay, we want to have David Cameron, or we want to have Theresa May. And then the actual ratification of that goes to the paid-up, dues-paying membership of the party, which is essentially anybody who's willing to come forward and say, I'm a Conservative, and here's my dues.
That's right, because the reason for that is that's the Conservative Party rules.
Okay.
The Labour Party could do it a different way. I know in this particular case, and in fact in the previous case, so the two cases in recent years where we've had these elections, where Theresa May was victorious, and now where Boris Johnson has won, in both cases the Conservative Party have not just choosing a new party leader, they have been choosing a new Prime Minister, because they were in administration at the time when the sitting prime minister resigned. So it's a double effect. We're choosing who is going to be the leader of our party. And because we're in government, we're also choosing the person who's going to be the leader of the country. Yeah, it strikes a lot of people in Britain as being pretty distasteful that, goodness me, are we really saying now that the prime minister is chosen from a group of very unrepresentative, white, mainly quite elderly, Tory party members. But that's the way it works, and until the Tory party change it, that's the way it will continue to work.
That's very interesting, Bill, and it seems to me to be the exact chronological opposite of how we do it here. As we were just discussing, we have a series of primaries, and that's when the party rules control. In fact, right now there's a great deal of discussion of the Democratic Party primary rules and how they're going through a winnowing process that basically comes down to, you know, how much money have you raised and what's your standing in the polls. And if you're high enough, you get to come to the next debate. And then eventually there'll be a Democratic Party nominee. So all the party stuff happens first. And then we have a presidential election. And then that is, of course, also criticized with the Electoral College and the rest of it. But at least it is to some extent representative of what the people of the whole country want. But you do it in the opposite order, which I find very interesting.
I don't want to portray the country I live in totally at odds with the concept of democracy. We are talking here about quite an unusual situation where a sitting prime minister resigns. I know in your country, If the president were to be forced out of office or to resign through ill health, you have all of these mechanisms built into your written constitution as to who would take over. And you obviously also have rules for impeachment as well, and that's codified. But we're talking about a situation here, as I say, where the Prime Minister has stepped down because he or she no longer feels that he or she has the confidence of Parliament and the party. So these are quite unusual. Over the Tory party, this has happened about four times in a post-war period.
So if this were just a pure election, and there were a general election and the Tories came out on top, then they would just have a parliamentary vote and they wouldn't actually put it to the membership in that circumstance?
No, what happens is if it were a general election, before going into the general election, the party would have a leader. And the convention is, and it is a convention, that the leader would then be invited by the Queen to form a government. So it's known when you, although in the United Kingdom, and of course we've got the issue of devolution, but although in the United Kingdom for a Westminster election, technically you're voting for a party to form a government, in reality, people know that your vote, the leader of the party will be the Prime Minister. And it is said in Britain that our elections are becoming more presidential in nature because more and more power is being concentrated with the executive at the expense of the legislative arm of our state. So the leader of the party going into an election, if he or she is successful, is in a very powerful position and then has the power of patronage to select ministers.
Let's just give a moment to I refer to her without condescension, but with genuine sympathy to Theresa May, who seems to me to be among, it's occurred to me she must have regretted that decision to take that position as Prime Minister every day for the past couple of years.
I think so. And I think when people say, will history judge her very badly, I think the sensible answer, I've not heard many people give this because people have been asked on television, how will history judge Theresa May? And most people have said, you know, pretty poorly. And I think the sensible, more measured answer is, well, let's see what Boris Johnson makes of Brexit. Because I think he may only last 6 months. And it may well be that in 6 months' time, people are saying, well, do you know what? Actually, Theresa May probably came closer to achieving a reasonable resolution to Brexit than Boris Johnson did, and what will the next person after Boris Johnson? I'm not saying Boris Johnson is going to lose his premiership over Brexit, but it doesn't look good for him.
Let's hold off on Boris and just one more thing.
Sure, but all I'm saying is that Theresa May, it's very, I take your point that she may well regret it. She did have a great sense of public duty, and I believe that. I don't think that was an act. She had a great sense of public duty. She did her best to get through what was many people saw as a compromise deal. And of course, she just didn't have the support of Parliament. So she had to step down. But I have a good deal of sympathy for her. Really.
Yeah, so do I. She essentially was trying to bargain with the European Union without having a clear consensus back at home. And so is it fair to say that basically over the last 3 years, she would go off to Brussels, come back with a deal, and then Parliament would vote it down and would express no consensus as to what they wanted.
Pretty close to that, yeah. I mean, what happened was her serious tactical mistake, was that she called an election in 2017. She had a majority at that stage of, I think, about 30. And she saw the opinion polls, which showed that the Tories had a 24-point lead over Labour. And the general consensus was the Tories would destroy Labour and Theresa May would be returned with a majority of 100 or something like that. And Theresa May's argument is that she wanted a stronger mandate in order to carry through Brexit. Cynics and the sceptics said the reason you're calling an election now is because you see an opportunity to secure a greater majority, as much as anything, for your, you know, for the benefit of the Conservative Party over the Labour Party. But whatever the motive was, she conducted the election pretty dreadfully. She came over as, you know, people said very robotic, as very unemotive, very poor performer in terms of putting out a message. It was very choreographed, very stage managed, whereas Jeremy Corbyn was very much in his element. He's always been a campaigner. There's nothing more he likes than standing on a soapbox or standing on a stage and speaking to hundreds or thousands of people. And he did energize young people, bizarrely, because he's a little bit like
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders, yeah. The different end of the age spectrum. And yet you had this energy from Corbyn, and people voted for him in large numbers, but not sufficiently large numbers for him to be returned as Prime Minister. But he did massively reduce the electoral deficit, so to speak, and the Conservatives were not returned with an overall majority, and they've had to depend upon the support of the Democratic Unionist Party in Ulster, in Northern Ireland, and of that, because of the arithmetic, and it's really all down to numbers in the last 3 years, particularly last 2 years since 2017, she destroyed the possibility of getting Brexit through by the way she conducted the election campaign, and the numbers have not been with us since then. But it's a precarious majority in the House of Commons, precarious.
And the last straw occurred earlier this year when she tried yet again to bring something to Parliament.
So what happened was is that it was agreed in Parliament that there would be a motion for withdrawal. So there's an Act of Parliament, which is it's the European Union Withdrawal Act, and that establishes that the UK will withdraw from the European Union. But she wanted to get an agreement through with the European Union. Again, as we said before, the agreement was seen to be in two phases. Phase one would deal with what they thought at the time would be relatively straightforward issues. This was just a preliminary, and we're still on stage one, which gives you some idea as to how difficult that has been. Mm. And the three issues are, just to remind your listeners, were the payment of monies, any outstanding debts to the European Union as a member of the club, and that's where this £39 billion figure comes from. The second issue was what would happen to the citizen status of European Union citizens living in Britain. Would they be aliens? Would they be legal citizens? Would they have citizen rights? Would they get British passport and so on? And also, by extension, what would happen to British citizens living in places like Spain and France? And there are large numbers of British citizens living in those places. Because, of course, at the moment, you know, my passport is a citizen of the European Union, whereas it used to be I was a subject of Her Majesty of the United Kingdom. And we have a purple passport rather than a traditional black passport. And then the third issue, and this, of course, has been a real stumbling block, has been what to do with the Northern Irish border. The problem here is that although I ought to say, just to fast forward, the next big chapter after these three issues were dealt with was the trade agreements. You know, what would be the trade arrangements between the United Kingdom and the European Union? But the Northern Ireland border issue was treated as one of the preliminary issues, whereas actually it's intrinsically interlinked with the trade issue. And the reason that this is such a problem is that the Northern Ireland is the only part of the United Kingdom that fronts onto a land border with the European Union. That is Ireland. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Ireland, so, the Republic
so
of
England,
Ireland.
Scotland and Wales is often... England, Scotland, Wales is an island surrounded by sea.
Right.
But Northern Ireland fronts onto Ireland. And, of course, it's an emotive historical subject. We all know about the issues of the Good Friday Agreement, which many saw as a resolution to the troubles which started in the 1960s, but obviously go back, you know, 100 or so years before that. And the Good Friday Agreement brought peace to Northern Ireland, peace between the Catholics and the Protestants. And one of the consequences of that peace was that all of these lookout towers along the border, which were heavily militarized with antennae, soldiers, barbed wire, you know, everything goes with it, heavily armored vehicles, all of those were demolished and removed. And you now have a seamless border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. People move over it, goods move over it, etc. And the European Union said, well, hang on, now that the United Kingdom wants to leave the European Union, there is an issue because we don't want smuggling. We don't want people smuggling. We don't want smuggling of goods. We don't want arbitrage. There'll be issues about what will happen to whether there'll be tariffs on goods moving across those borders. The border is incredibly complex. You can actually pass from Northern Ireland to Ireland and back again along a road and not know it. There aren't even signs on many of the back roads because there would be border signs all over the place.
That sounds like our border with Canada.
Well, it isn't. In many ways, it's quite the opposite because your border with Canada is just a long, straight 49th parallel line.
Roads do cross it.
Up in New England, obviously, it's more contorted. Mm-hmm. But the Northern Irish border is, you know, you've got situations where it actually goes down the middle of roads, not across roads, but down the middle of roads. Traffic on one side of the road is in Northern Ireland, on the other side of the road is in Ireland. So it's that that has really been a stumbling block, and that led to this expression, the backstop, which we'll get on to. But what happened was that Theresa May appointed in her new government in 2016 and then in 2017, she appointed people who were very pro-Brexit to senior positions to have responsibility for negotiating free trade deals. That was a chap called Liam Fox. Negotiating the removal of Britain from the European Union. That was a chap called David Davis. And Boris, of course, was Foreign Secretary, who would also have a key role in this. So you had three strongly identified Brexiteer parliamentarians who were heading up government ministries, which were really given responsibility for arranging Brexit. But what happened last July, so about this time last year, there was the Chequers Agreement. And the Chequers Agreement was an agreement that had been drawn up almost in secret by Theresa May and was presented to Boris Johnson, David Davis and Liam Fox and other members of the cabinet at Chequers, which is the country retreat. It's a grace and favour home for the Prime Minister in Buckinghamshire. And they were all sent there to discuss this new agreement. And David Davis resigned. He said, look, I never had any hand in this. What's the point of my job if you're doing the negotiating for us? And essentially, the Chequers agreement was a compromise agreement. It was a middle-of-the-road agreement to try and withdraw from the European Union to honour the important pledges that the government had given, which is to take back control of our, I can't believe I'm saying this, I'm sounding like the Prime Minister, she said it thousands of times, to take back control of our money, our laws and our borders, and take back sovereignty. And they said, well, yes, to a point, but it includes this backstop arrangement. When they started looking through the small print of this 508-page document, they found in there this commitment that in the event that there is no agreement between the United Kingdom and the European Union in the transition period. Now, the transition period follows withdrawal. So withdrawal was going to take effect from March the 29th of 2019. That's in the Act. Now, it's been extended, and I'll come on to that. But the transition period would be the next 20 months, 22 months, I think, till December 2020. Where the European Union and the United Kingdom would negotiate over trade. So the first stage is we leave the European Union, having resolved the issues of our outstanding payments, citizen rights for European Union people, and the Northern Ireland issue. And the second phase, the transition, which would take place between March 2019 and December 2020, would be a period in which we would negotiate a trade arrangement with the European Union. And what the backstop said was, in the event that the trade agreement is not achieved during that transition period, the British government will agree that Northern Ireland will remain part of the customs union. Well, people in Northern Ireland said, hang on a moment, you're treating us as being separate from the United Kingdom. And that goes to the issue of the union, because as soon as you start saying to particularly people on the Protestant side, well, Northern Ireland will constitutionally be treated in a different way from England, Wales and Scotland, the arms go up and say, you can't do that. That's an abdication of the Union.
So the United Kingdom,
that immediately raised the heckles of the DUP, who said, what are you doing? You can't treat Northern Ireland as in that way.
And Theresa May needed the DUP for her majority.
Exactly. So the alternative then was to say, well, in that case, it will be the whole of the United Kingdom that will stay within the customs union. I'll explain the customs union in a minute, until such time as there's a resolution to this problem, to which people said, Boris Johnson said, we will become a vassal state. We will become de facto a member of the European Union, or we will remain a member of the European Union. But it will be worse than our current membership arrangement, because we'll be a member, but without actually having a seat at the table in terms of the governance of the European Union. So we'll have left in terms of having elected representatives and a commissioner and members on the European executive, but we'll still be dictated to, effectively. We'll still be subject to the laws and regulations of the European Union, because we will be a member of the customs union. Now, the customs union is a mechanism within the European Union that allows the free flow of goods and goods in particular between different member states without being subject to border checks. So it's pretty important. Most people agree it would be highly desirable to keep it, but there are implications of keeping it, which Brexiteers say, hang on a moment, we're not sure it's worth, you know, it's a price worth paying.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. This week, my guest is William Walton, a British barrister and a guy who seems to know more about Brexit than anybody I know. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with William Walton, all about Brexit, sort of. Because you see, our next episode is also going to feature Bill talking about Brexit, because we just couldn't cover it all in one episode. But let's finish up for now.
Now, I explained to you before that the other mechanism, the other defining pact of the European Union, which is, or character feature of the European Union, is the single market. And that is the four fundamental freedoms of the free movement of goods, of labor, capital, and services. Did I say goods, people, capital, and services? And those are fundamental freedoms which come with membership of the European Union. Now, there are two countries, and we've talked about this before, as to are there models that the United Kingdom could use as a sort of being a kind of semi-member of the European Union. And this was talked about in the debates leading up to the referendum, that, well, we could become like Norway. Now, Norway is a member of the single market, but it's not a member of the European Union. Or you could become like Turkey. Turkey is a member of the customs union, but not a member of the European Union. The downside is that if you're a member of the single market, like Norway is, you pay money into the, you still pay fees. You're paying membership fees at a mitigated rate, but you are still paying fees. And you're having to accept, of course, a free movement of labor. And it was a free movement of labor that was really, it was a critical issue in the 2016 election referendum, because the United Kingdom has been a net importer of around 150,000 EU citizens each year.
Which brings us to one of the other essential things. Perhaps it's a variation on the theme of sovereignty, but very much like we're having a debate over immigration here, that was sure at the heart of a lot of the Brexiteers' opposition to the EU, was this free movement of labor into Britain.
Yes, and it's often been suggested that the Brexit vote was carried in large part by disaffected white working class people. Very similar to the Trump phenomena. People who working in places, living in places like Sunderland, just down the road from where I am, and other Labour heartlands such as the north of England, Leeds, West Yorkshire, the West Midlands, Birmingham, Wolverhampton, what's sometimes called the Black Country, and South Wales. These are areas which have been the bedrock of Labour Party support, really, since the Labour Party was founded in, you know, start of the 20th century. But these, many voters in these constituencies have become disaffected with large scale in migration. Now, having said that, there's a little bit here of a, that's a cliche, and some of the voting analysis suggests that it's not quite as clean cut as that, but it is an important issue. That a lot of the, and this is a problem for Jeremy Corbyn, that Jeremy Corbyn's leader of a party where in the South, Labour voters tend to be strongly pro-Remain, and in the North, to a large extent, voters tend to be strongly pro-Brexit. And this is why Labour has really embarked on a policy of what they call constructive ambiguity, which is to say really very little about where we stand. It's to say we're in favour of Brexit, but we want a better deal than the Conservatives can achieve. Well, it's easy to say that, but it's very difficult to achieve a better deal than the Conservatives can achieve. And it sends out mixed messages to voters. Are you for or are you against? And most people probably think that Jeremy Corbyn is in favour of Brexit, although, you know, he says that he voted for Remain. But, the argument for Labour, and I can understand this, is that they want to honour, they feel there's a democratic issue of honouring the vote of the referendum, which was 17.4 million against 16.8 million or something like that. So, you know, was it a 1.2, something like a 1.2 million difference. It was a 52-48, as you know. That figure's been repeated a good deal.
Right.
And it is a difficult position for political parties. But going back to, you know, where we are in Parliament, most of the parliamentarians are Remain. And this is an issue that's of concern to a lot of voters, that Parliament is largely composed of Remain sympathetic MPs.
There's so many similarities with our politics these days, and one of them we're touching upon right now. Your parliamentarians, I think, correlate to what we call establishment politicians in the United States, and I'm particularly thinking of establishment Republicans, who by and large are in favor of traditional conservative values, U.S. leadership, membership in NATO, internationalism, free trade. All of these things that the establishment has favored for years are now being challenged by the more populist members of the Republican Party. And bit by bit, it seems that the populists keep gaining influence and the establishment keeps waning. And it sounds to me like that's what's happening to a great extent in Britain.
Well, if you were to listen to Nigel Farage, the leader now of the Brexit Party, having left the UKIP Party, he would repeat that. He would say that exactly. And as you know, he's a close friend of Donald Trump, mm-hmm. and he often says that 2016 was the year that shook the world. You know, it was the election of Donald Trump in America on a populist mandate. Italian politics, you have the rise of the the Northern League, and populism in Italy. There's populism now emerging in Germany and France, and of course in Britain it manifested itself with Brexit. So there's a good deal of truth in this. I mean, to a certain extent, the term establishment, I find it is a little bit hypocritical, because people like Nigel Farage, who went to one of the most expensive public schools in Britain and was a stockbroker and has been an MEP for 20 years, a member of the European Parliament.
But the parallels continue. Donald Trump was born into some of the greatest privilege available in the United States, basically inherited everything he ever got. That's true of many of his close friends and supporters. And so they pose, as you say, somewhat hypocritically as populists, even one of the people, even though that's not what they are.
Sure.
You've mentioned Boris Johnson several times during this discussion.
No, but you must be delighted that he's leader, because he's a former journalist. He was cast out into the political wilderness. And after being cast out into political wilderness, he's returned as leader of his party at a time of national emergency. There must be parallels here, Stuart, with one of your favourite British parliamentarian, or your favourite British Prime Minister.
With Churchill, you mean? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, he's modelled himself on Churchill. He wrote a book last year, which you may have seen, a book on Churchill, which has been quite widely acclaimed, because it's probably difficult to write a book on Churchill and say anything new.
Mm-hmm.
So many other people have done the same. But he is first and foremost, in many ways, a he's a wordsmith. He's a journalist, as Churchill was. And he was cast out into the political wilderness to a certain extent. And he's a person who will find out what he's like. But the impression given is that he's a bit of a bumbler, but actually extremely bright, extremely bright.
Well, let's talk about his journalistic background. Now, Churchill did go out and write articles and books that just basically summarized his adventures. He had one of the most adventurous lives of anybody, I think, in human history. But by and large, I think he's respected for the relative accuracy of his reporting, both in his articles and in his books. In fact, I think he won the Nobel Prize in large part because of his magisterial histories of the First and Second World Wars. So he's respected. Johnson, not so much. Johnson basically was what we would call a tabloid reporter and was known for making stuff up, right? Stuff about the European Union.
Yes, that is true, actually. He was the Evening Standard, or certainly he worked at the Spectator, which is a weekly periodical sort of house magazine of the Conservative Party. And he's had to relinquish it, but he was a columnist for the Daily Telegraph, and he received about $350,000 a year for that. And he used it really to start putting together what one might call a platform for his views. And of course, he was deliberately provocative. It was this time last year, August last year, he referred to women, Muslim women wearing the hijab, as like letterboxes. Mm. And this was inevitably, as he knew it would be, it was the leading item of news. Was this acceptable? Was this acceptable or distasteful or outright racist in this day and age? And he's made other sort of barbed comments like that, knowing that there's a reputation he's got, which is, well, Boris will be Boris, and there are apologists for him, like the Prime Minister, who said sometimes, well, Boris will be Boris, you know, he's he can be a bit of a boy at times, you know, that kind of attitude, which is that
which is very nice right when you're actually talking about a boy, but this is a grown man with an extremely loose relationship with the truth, with a willingness to sensationalize things, with a desire, it appears, to attack other people in ways that are bigoted, perhaps racist. Again, the parallels seem to be pretty strong. I mean, we have a guy in the White House who's known for all those same things.
Well, and he's going to fly over to Washington, D.C. in the next week or two, so we understand, to meet with President Trump. He's got to be careful on this, because he knows that Trump is a little bit like, we call it Marmite. I don't know what you call it in the United States, but Marmite, as you possibly know, is yeast extract, which some people put on their toast. And it's got this reputation, you know, it's for being something that people either love or hate. And there's an element of that with Boris, and obviously there's an element about it with Trump. And Trump is toxic in some ways in this country. As you know, he was over here for the Normandy commemorations at the start of June. Mm-hmm. And he was accorded a state visit, which is something that perhaps we give these out too freely now. But as you know, what that means is that essentially the visit comes from, the invitation comes from the Queen rather than from the government. And what that means is that he gets to go to a state banquet and sit next to the Queen. And of course, no doubt those pictures were shown all around the United States, and it put him in a very good light. But 2 or 3 weeks later, having said that he loved his visit over here, I can't remember what prompted this, but he sent out one of his tweets saying that Theresa May was a loser and he'd enjoyed going over to Britain only because he'd met the Queen. And it came across as being pretty rude and disrespectful. And I think if Boris Johnson is very close to Trump, people know in this country that Trump says America first, and he's a businessman, and he'll negotiate a trade agreement that is as favorable as possible to the United States. You'd expect him to do that. I don't think there's anything, I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with that. He's a president of the United States, not Britain. you look after the United States, and our Prime Minister hopefully will look after this country.
Well, I'm going to quibble with you a little bit on this, because at least since the Second World War, for the most part, I perceive the U.S. as certainly acting in its own interest, but in a way that was less narrowly focused on immediate economic advantage and more broadly focused on lifting up every boat in our common ocean. I mean, that to me is what international leadership is, or at least was, for many decades. So you don't go into a situation trying to skin the other fellow. You go into a situation hoping to get an agreement that's mutually beneficial and that will help the entire NATO and Europe and Western democracies, Western-style democracies all over the world. And that was the united front that we, for better or worse, or more or less, presented to our opponents behind the Iron Curtain. That sort of leadership seems to be out of fashion these days, and everybody is narrowly focused on short-term advantages in a zero-sum game. We've been down that road before. It doesn't typically end well.
Well, we will see, you know, what happens here. I mean, one of the things that your president was asked during his visit was at a news conference, would a trade agreement be designed so as to allow American pharmaceutical companies access to contracts with the National Health Service? Now, that was a plan. That was a question which everybody in Britain knew why it was asked, and Trump said the wrong thing. And I think people were expecting him in a way to say the wrong thing, which of course Trump said, well, of course, you know, everything's got to be on the table. And that's, you know,
that would fundamentally change.
It's an eligibility question. The only answer you can give, which is politically acceptable in Britain to most people, would be to say no. Your NHS is not going to be part of any trade negotiation, because we appreciate that your NHS is almost a religion to you. And
National Health Service. You all have
National Health Service.
You have universal health care there.
And that's right, and
to allow American private insurance companies to bid on entering that non-market, because it's not a market, it's a national policy. I think he really stepped in it on that one.
But all we're saying is that be careful. You know, the idea that President Trump, and he presents himself sometimes as saying, "I really want to do Britain a great deal," you know, because I've got a lot of time for Britain. You know, we're not that stupid.
Oh, I hate to cut off this wonderful discussion here, but never fear. Next week, Bill will be back, and we will finish our discussion of Brexit. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephant. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, which is kind of part of the British experiment.